Hello, welcome back to Tribal Take Right Live. I'm your host, Christian Gray. And today we have a very exciting show for you today. It's not the typical format where you have my 15 to 20 minute rant, then music, then a guest. We're going to do the guest right away and try to spend the whole hour, maybe a little bit more, discussing the evils of local cops and law enforcement. My special guest on the line now is Robert Finkelfin, and he's from North Texas, and he's written some excellent articles at faithandheritage.com, and I have that link on tribaltheocrat.com, so check that out. Robert's a friend of mine and a man whose great mind I admire. He has a lot to share regarding the evils of law enforcement, and if we don't get through all of it today, he's promised to come back in November to finish up. So without further ado, I welcome my guest, Robert.
Thank you, Christian. Glad to be on here.
Good to have you here. Let me turn your volume up just a little bit. Can you hear me okay?
Hey, you're coming through loud and clear.
Excellent. How's your week been?
Fortunately, I haven't gotten pulled over or arrested or shot at by police. all in all, you could say it's been pretty good. Only a couple, three more hours left to go before I can say another week free and clear of the police state threat.
Well, if we can keep you out of the slammer for the next 3 hours, we've done a good thing. We have a couple lead-in stories to talk about. One of them is one that most people are aware of, and that's one that happened in Florida where some cops knocked on the wrong apartment door, and the man, the owner of the apartment, answered the door with his firearm drawn because the police did not identify themselves, and the cops shot the man dead. And a second story, which I don't know much about, it's blacks and Mexicans running amok in Chicago. If you'd like to give some commentary on either one of those or both, that'd be great.
Well, dealing with the last story, basically it was an issue of where blacks and Mexicans using petty intimidation tactics of walking along, say, on a sidewalk, four abreast, to force someone who was walking in the opposite direction to get into the gutter, or where they would block the door of a restaurant or store, any sort of establishment, thus forcing people to ask for permission to go into the store. Of course, if they tried to handle the issue on their own and touch these people, particularly with underage kids that were, say, 17 and younger, if a person that tries to shove them out of the way, then they can call the police and claim that, well, they were, underage youth being harassed by someone else and have the police pursue that. And just basically an example of how the police state can't even accomplish the stated goal that it's after to prevent crime, and it prevents non-government alternatives to that, which cost nothing and are free. Obviously, the more heinous of the two stories was the incident that happened in Florida, where a man's life was taken, and where police are so paranoid, I believe now, probably in large part due to the evil that they've done. And I think probably in terms of theological grounds of where evildoers feel the coming judgment of God upon them, and sometimes that results in a paranoid reaction. Plus the fact that at police academies, probably going on now for a quarter of a century, but it keeps getting worse year after year, the police are told to have absolute control of every situation and not allow any sort of unknown variables. And so a man shows up at the door. They obviously had not announced their presence and, should have been, at least somewhat wary that, okay, well, maybe the man's not going to answer the door. Maybe someone else will. And then they ended up, killing him, only to find out that they were at the wrong address. So it's not really something you can take back. But I think both stories illustrate very well just the magnitude of the problem that we're facing right now of police that are not by any means considered rogue or corrupt, where they kill someone and nothing will be done to them about it, or the instance in Chicago where you have just this ongoing intimidation threat taking place by minorities, blacks and Mexicans predominantly, although there may be Asiatic gangs involved as well, and where the man on the street is not free to deal with the problem in and of itself. So, and unfortunately, you know, those two kinds of stories pretty much repeat themselves, you know, every week. That if we do it in the show again in November, with any follow-on, the thing is that we would have enough stories that would take place in the next 3 months, or we could fill probably the top drawer of any filing cabinet, and that would just be the material that's online, and you know, not, and most things that happen aren't even reported.
Sure.
So, yeah, that's just a quick review of the threat we're facing for any of the listeners who maybe have not paid much attention to that issue because they've looked at fractional reserve banking or the problems we face with interracial marriage. I think those two stories alone will give a lot of credence to the topic we're discussing.
The interesting about the Florida story is if it were you or me who went to that same guy's door and knocked with no announcement, and if we were shot or if we were to shot that guy dead because he was drawn, we'd have been in trouble, wouldn't we?
There was an instance of that happening. I don't remember where in the country. I think for listeners who want to look at the YouTube version of the Florida story, I believe in the comments it's mentioned that that did happen at one point. I believe it was a sheriff's department, and the man who answered it, upon seeing they were undercover deputies who were armed and started being immediately belligerent, that this man did kill them. And he eventually was acquitted in court, but it cost him, he used up all of his life savings and legal fees, and I think it took, probably a year, year and a half, or maybe even longer, before he was finally acquitted. So, it became very much a nightmare for him, and then he probably still faces the threat of action by police, phoning in death threats, and all they have to do is really just pull him over on the side of the road and kill him, and then, if there's an investigation, just say, well, I noticed a busted taillight, and I pulled him over, and then the assailant went for a gun, and I had to kill him. And like right. many police, they very often will carry throwdown pieces to plant on people, yes. and there's not a grand jury in America that would have indicted them for that sort of thing. So, the poor man probably ended up having to move to another town if he wanted some degree of safety after that. Yeah, it shows a great disparity of where these the two men who killed the individual in Florida will probably receive some letter of commendation for their files. I mean, most of them get them for doing nothing, and there will maybe 2 or 3 weeks of paid vacation via suspension. Whereas if the as you point out, if the apartment dweller had killed the police, well then he would have a nightmare that would just be beginning for him.
Sure, there was a story that came across my Twitter feed today. And I don't know the details, but to paraphrase, a young black man was arrested and put in the back of a police car, handcuffed, in the back of a locked car, and the report was that the young man committed suicide. He suffered a gunshot to the head while he was handcuffed in custody in a cop car, and the mother of the dead boy is now complaining that some foul play may have happened here. She doesn't see how it's possible for her son to shoot himself with a gun that didn't exist while he's handcuffed. And I just wonder how prominent this issue is of cops planting these spare guns on guys they deem to dispatch.
I used to work with a fellow electrical engineer, and he was from New York City, and his brother was with the NYPD, and he thought that that for whatever reason I was sympathetic to police, which I'm not, but he started telling me about some of the antics his brother had told him about, and he had just mentioned that most of them will carry a cheap handgun of some sort, or if not that, at least a knife, and if they shoot someone and then discover that, as in the case of the man that had the wallet, the menacing wallet that was shot 32 times, several times, probably back in the mid part of the last decade, that they would carry this as a plant just for the fact that it would get them out of trouble.
Exactly.
And you wonder if their conscience bothers them or not. I'm sure it does to some extent. But, where they've already well thought this out in advance of how to deal with these kind of situations, which, tells you that they're functioning on a hair trigger.
Yes.
Very much they're not trying to make sure, okay, the man has a weapon, and if so, is he using it properly? I would like to think that if I had a man met me at his apartment door and he had a handgun at his side, if the gun's at the side, it's not a threat to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, once again, you're dealing with the, you know, the academy training of, you know, any slightest little threat, react to it and deal with it. And with the nature of so many police coming up through the public school system, where they are taught in kind of, you know, a zero tolerance environment, that you do exactly as you're told, and then particularly for the police that go on into the military, where that environment has been very much process, rule, procedure based for decades. I mean, it was bad back when I was in the Air Force in the late 1980s, but just where you immediately, you know, where there's no judgment required, you just follow the rules and processes and procedures. So they see, oh, gun, okay, I must shoot. And most police in general, their IQs are, they're lower than the general population. They like having rules to follow, and mm-hmm. as a matter of fact, you know, they're not really peace officers anymore, as you pointed out before, that they are law enforcement officers. And so they are very much in their own line of work, are very much apt to that process type thinking. And you see that it's not just in law enforcement, the American business community, particularly larger corporations, they love, say, like, you know, the ISO 9000 type program, where everything is driven by processes and procedures. Of course, in real life, it doesn't really work that way, that, you know, not everything fits under a process or procedure neatly, and that's where you'll find a lot of large companies becoming, you know, very inefficient trying to use a standardized rule book. Well, the same thing with law enforcement, of where individual judgment calls and trying to make quick decisions should be emphasized and not so much playing by a rule book. And I'm sure for the Florida police that they'll just simply say, we followed procedures, and that's that.
Sure.
And, you know, there will be no recrimination to them. If there is any recrimination at all, it'll be a bad conscience on their end that, you know, may ultimately end up driving them to quit or do some bodily harm to themselves.
You've told me before offline that the idea of rule of law in an orderly society, that's becoming a curse, and the true model should be just a pursuit of justice.
We very much have become, I'm not entirely sure what forces has driven us in this direction, but where the rule of law is considered, you know, well, you've heard the term law-abiding citizen.
Right.
And it's as if, okay, well, that makes a righteous man because he's law-abiding. Well, I mean, you have many law-abiding people that are sons of hell. You know, trial attorneys, for one example. A lot of the people in the military who, you know, shot civilians in Iraq or Afghanistan, leftist congressmen, you know, all of whom are law-abiding citizens, but that doesn't mean that they're moral people. Mm-hmm. And I think just in terms of how Christianity in the latter part of the 1600s and through the mid-1700s started divorcing theology from morality and theology from the doctrine of the state, we've gotten to the point now of where that the orderliness is what is worshipped. And, you know, to have that orderliness, they have the rule of law. Instead, to me, my way of thinking, that vigilantism with resulting justice would be far more preferable than to have, you know, tyranny or anarcho-tyranny where we live now, where we have an oppressive, heavy-handed state, but we have anarchy via the criminal element and anarchy via the police element. But the rule of law is really not that wonderful thing after all. Once you get beyond the concept of where, okay, well, we want some sort of, you know, biblical guidelines for our behavior, and, you know, certainly a law system can be adapted from the Old Testament law that fits that. But, you know, where our current law code, if you were to take probably any, you know, person that lives in Chicago or any city for that matter, if they take all the rules and laws that they're subject to, it's well in the hundreds of thousands of different laws and regulations. And, you know, how perverse is that? It seems to me in a lot of areas of our life, whether it be the church or business, dealing with the criminal element, that we should be more focused on results and not how we get there. As it is, it's people are condemned for getting results, but they got there in a way that's deemed, you know, that did not follow proper channels. And you see this once again in, say, the government school system, where every day of the week, maybe a child is reading a book or even reading the assigned textbook and is learning from it, but he did not follow the teacher's directions specifically. This child may pass every standardized test, fine and dandy, but he's condemned because he did not follow the proper process and procedure. This, I think, in a lot of ways is something of a substitute for the lack of the sovereignty of God in society, of where we no longer have a all-controlling God, that now we have an all-controlling state. And certainly the decline of Calvinism led to the rise of statism, because the Arminian God is simply unable to handle the problem in. I mean, he can't even save the people he created, so how can he be expected to deal with the criminal element in his creation?
That's a great point. If you could discuss some major inherent systematic flaws of the law enforcement model.
Well, I would say that starting off, the police have a monopoly on force, and this is once again played out in the Chicago scenario with the kids walking four abreast on the sidewalk or blocking the entrances, where the citizen doesn't really have the means to handle any problem of itself. It, no matter what kind of free market type economic views people have, the problem of monopolies is well established, that quality of service goes down, quality of product goes down. That would be for a manufacturer, but you're starting to deal with police. Well, they have a monopoly on force, so they can pretty much act in any way that they want to, and that may include not responding to calls, not investigating crimes, or being heavy-handed whenever they feel like it. We've seen this major instances in the early 90s with Randy Weaver, his wife being assassinated by the FBI agent Lon Horiuchi, the Waco killings, once again, that were conducted by the FBI, and earlier the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And then more recently. Oh, beg your pardon?
Oh, I was going to say, didn't these, you're speaking of the Waco and Randy Weaver, didn't these things happen in the middle of a time where you're seeing a uprise in militias and local, just local citizenry taking...
Ambrose Evans Pritchard, in his book, The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, this is a man who writes, I believe, for the Times of London, and he's not, should not be considered a radical right-wing fanatic by any stretch of the imagination, but he believes that the Waco killings was what led to the drive of the militia movement.
I see.
I mean, certainly what was going on towards the end of the era of Bush, George H.W. Bush, where his crime bill had an assault weapons ban provision in it, of course the Clinton administration took that up, was already, I think, causing the desire in people to see the need for militias. But what happened in Waco was like a huge alarm, saying people need to figure out a way to protect themselves and their communities. This power gone amok that pretty much you look every decade going back some distance, probably, well, going back at least into the 20s and 30s when we had prohibition, that you had the revenuers, which were notorious in the tactics they used. Mm-hmm. Anything and everything was a steal, and you were producing illegally. And even before that, where the excise tax that was laid, which is unfortunately constitutionally allowed, that they wanted their fair share of excise tax, fair share being used in quotation marks. Mm-hmm. But the monopoly of force is just, it's very troubling. The public school system has a virtual monopoly, not a total monopoly, because of the private schooling, not system, but the private school movement and the homeschool movement have been increasingly challenging the public school movement the last 30 years, but still, 90 to 95% of kids who are of school age or are brought up in a public school, that they serve, the quality of service, their product is notoriously bad, and it's gotten worse every decade since the founding of the public school movement back in the 1860s and 1870s. So really, I would say, just by everything we understand about economics and just the human, the problems of human frailty, that putting all the force in one hand it was never a good idea. It was going to come apart.
Sure.
And Lord, the famous quote by Lord Acton, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Well, they have absolute power to some extent, and it has corrupted them a great deal. To me, at the end of the day, being a theonomist and holding to the Old Testament model, there's obviously many different flavors of theonomy. But if we take a very strict interpretation of the text, which I try to do as much as I can with the theonomic model, that there's no provision at all for the government to not only prevent crimes, but that there's no provision for them to investigate crimes either. Now, I think if people can come together and hire investigators to investigate crimes, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But the concentrating, you could say, two investigative powers as well as protection powers, the patrol officer being the individual who supposedly prevents crimes and maybe investigates smaller petty crimes, and then the detectives who are the investigative arm of the police establishment. Neither one really does their job all that well, and there's no competition to turn to unless you're very wealthy and can afford private investigators. Even then, private investigators, their access to critical information is very often impeded by police departments who correctly see, I believe, that private investigators are a threat to their profession. Yeah. In Dallas, I believe it was 2009, it may have been 2010, that the Dallas Police Department has grown increasingly hesitant to investigate auto theft crimes. So one or two, I don't know, I think it's two or three insurance agencies pooled their sources, who were losing obviously a good bit in car theft, and hired several private investigators to investigate, and ultimately they ended up pinning down the car theft ring. And that would be one example amongst many of where the private sector has outperformed and done a better job than the public sector. That would be, the monopoly of force, I would say, is one of the big problems with the concept of the police. Another one is the problem of an organization having to investigate itself, with internal affairs divisions looking into misdeeds by police.
Okay.
Large examples that we've seen of organizations failing to investigate themselves properly would be, say, the Warren Commission, which investigated the assassination of John F. Kennedy,
right,
and the 9/11 Commission, which looked into the 9/11 attacks. And the results of both commissions are just laughable.
I recall when I first started studying the JFK assassination, and I heard that the Warren Commission deliberately excluded there were dozens of people who claimed to hear shots from the grassy knoll, and that did not make it into the official investigation. I thought, this is bogus. How can it be called an investigation if you fail to record that?
Well, sure, and they were protecting the legitimacy of their own organization, the government, and whatever kind of shadow forces were actually behind Kennedy. I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent about the JFK assassination because it's a fascinating topic and we could talk hours about it. But I believe that Lyndon Baines Johnson certainly knew it was going to happen. I tend to think that he probably did not have a direct role in planning the assassination, but I believe he knew about it. And what happens if you pursue that to the natural conclusion? Oh, well, you have a sitting president, because the Warren Commission, I believe, released its report in 65 or 66. So we have a sitting president that knew in advance about the assassination of the President of the United States and did nothing about it. Out of such actions, the change of regime and losing faith in institutions is important. And Earl Warren, who was one of the most leftist members ever of the Supreme Court, he was very much a statist and did not want to see that level of trust that the American people still had, particularly in the first half of the 1960s, dissipate. And there may even have been threats on his own life from people inside the organization. But we've seen since then, you've read revisionist works on the Kennedy assassination, we've seen lone individuals who have done a much more thorough, superior job of investigating the events of the Kennedy assassination than the Warren Commission. And the same thing with the 9/11 Commission, where the government's conspiracy theory of these Arabs supposedly hijacking the planes and crashing into the main two World Trade Center buildings, and yet let alone the never even explains the Building 7 story, just terrible jobs on large events that everyone has seen. And that would be kind of a macro event. The micro event that, say, an individual is roughed up by police or where they steal from them, the idea that Internal Affairs is going to come out and is going to give a very thorough, objective reporting. It's farcical. It's laughable.
It is.
The idea that men, who the solidarity that exists amongst police departments, and I realize that always in the movies that Internal Affairs is considered utterly hated, but those men bleed blue too. And at some point, they may want to go back into the normal aspect of the police world. And, you know, they're not going to burn a cop unless he's really, really bad. And there's always the threat, too, of recriminations by people in the existing police department. The event involving Serpico in the New York Police Department back in the 1970s, or was it late 1960s or early 1970s?
I'm not sure.
But there was a movie made about it with Al Pacino where this man was he was a cop, and he'd reported misdeeds of some sort, and he was very much in fear of his life. So that would be, you know, the second problem I see is the problem of an organization investigating itself. The third major issue I see, and we can kind of, you know, bring it in with the fourth, but for now I say the problem with no accountability, that is with the Florida killing. What's going to happen? Well, nothing will happen. So those men are not held accountable. It happens all the time. You know, a policeman who's drunk driving a police car too quickly, or maybe he's just driving it quickly for the pure joy of it, hits someone. Nothing ever happens to them. There's been an established pattern that has gone on, I don't know how many years, but certainly since the time I've been alive, that policemen can do pretty much anything they want and not be held in account by it. This kind of ties back into the problem of the monopoly as well, in that, who would hold the police in check? Well, in the American system, the trend has been for more and more centralizing power. So typically the FBI would get involved to investigate local police. Okay, well, who's going to investigate the FBI? Well, they're an inspector general department, probably. But who's going to hold them accountable? I would say in a true biblical society, you are going to have power. It's not going to be an anarcho-capitalist state, but you are going to have power, but you want that power to be widely distributed and thinly, where the power is, the layer of it is very thin. It's not concentrated in one or two places, but where it is widely distributed and where every man essentially has police powers.
Right.
Now, he may not be a part of the posse. He may not be someone that one of the few small amount of full-time police that we might have, but he would still have the powers of arrest. He would still have the powers of open carrying. And he would be able to investigate crimes if he so sought to. That would be the way of creating accountability in the system. Of course, the problem with that for the police is if we had such a system, why do we need 90 to 95% of the police at that point? We wouldn't. And I think at some point policemen are very aware of there's just a thin line that stands between them and their departments utterly dissolving. The fourth major thing that I see as a problem is that policemen are called to be professional witnesses, of where part of their job is testifying in court against people, or they issue a ticket. Well, that is considered, you know, where they would be called to testify that so and so was driving, some person was driving at such and such speed. This is again, you know, very problematic to me in that the idea of a paid professional witness. If you're not dealing with a non-cop, that's called jury tampering. It's called tampering with a witness. The idea that you pay someone to be a witness, it creates all kinds of problems because they're ultimately going to favor whoever pays them. And so that the police normally testify in favor of the state time and time again. There was a interview conducted way back in October of 93, and for your listeners, I apologize for using kind of a cryptic source like this. It was in Soldier of Fortune magazine, but the fact that this problem is ages old, just one reason why I mention this, but it was an ATF agent who had seen a lot of problems inside the bureau, and he had agreed to do an interview with Soldier of Fortune magazine. And he was just talking about how routinely agents were pressured to not tell the whole truth, to forget facts that were not conducive for the prosecution to gain a conviction.
Now, ATF is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Yes, and now it is the BATFE, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, it always just gets truncated with the Bureau, the B left off when people are referring to it. I can't. They used to be under the Department of Treasury since they collected excise taxes on alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. But I believe now they're under the Department of Homeland Security, which was another lovely legacy that George W. Bush left us. All these problems of the four issues, to me, stem back to an issue of total depravity, which is part of the Calvinistic scheme of salvation. It's obviously much larger than just the issue of salvation, but where man has been extremely corrupted by the effects of sin and where he can't find God on his own. And yet, we're going to trust all this power to an individual man. There's been, to me, some very contradictory thinking by many of our contemporary Calvinistic thinkers of where they would say, well, men aren't angels, so we have to have law enforcement. Well, I would use the very line against them. Well, men aren't angels, so we can't have concentrated power in law enforcement. To me, I don't think they're really consistent Calvinists in judging from the problems that you and I have both seen in circles and say the Presbyterian Church of America or different seminaries, that you have a crisis in Calvinism today of where people are trying to defend the American system first and foremost, and then they want to tack on Calvinism on top of that. And it doesn't really work that well, where their theology is being driven by their political science, a term I absolutely hate, but it's driven by their political science, their views of government, their political nationalism, and it's created a very faulty theology as a result. And someone could take just those four points. The late Christian philosopher and apologist that we're both fond of, Dr. Greg Bahnsen, I liked how he would use examples of where he could say, if you have almost no interest in apologetics, you could still learn just a few issues and use them to pretty much go against anyone who's spouting unbelief. And to me, these four issues here, when understood under the Calvinistic rubric of total depravity, pretty much undermines the case for law enforcement, certainly as it is now. And as it is now, we have about, the numbers are sometimes a little hard to pin down. I've seen numbers as low as about 910,000 and as high as 965,000 people who work in law enforcement. And by that, I'm referring to airport police, school district police, city police, county sheriff's departments, county constables, state police of various sorts, and then the numerous, numerous federal alphabet soup agencies, whether it be the ATFE, the FBI, U.S. Marshals, Drug Enforcement Agency, and even the post office has a SWAT team, for pity's sake.
Wow.
So you're dealing with almost a million people that are involved in full-time law enforcement.
Yeah,
we have 300. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Go ahead.
We have nearly 300 million people living in the U.S., or maybe a little over, a little under. Out of that, you would have probably a people in the workforce that I would guess would number probably at least 250 million. And we're saying, that one out of every 250 working age adults is involved in law enforcement. That's just, how would that system work? And that is for the term they love, the sworn officers. We're not talking about the people that maintain the police cars, the dispatchers, administrative staff, the offices, the cost of the cars themselves, the cost of training and the firing ranges. The tax liability and burden due to law enforcement is just, it's enormous. I mean, if you got rid of all other government expenditures in and of themselves, I believe very confidently, if you were to tally the cost of law enforcement, the cost of providing for the numerous people who are currently in jail or in prison, and the cost of paying for the correctional officers that oversee the people in prison, then you'd probably be looking at close to a 5% tax burden just from that alone. And I kind of smile anytime I'll hear people say from what's the name of the so-called constitutional law enforcement group, Oath Keepers.
Okay.
Where they'll say, okay, well, we believe in, you know, constitutional law enforcement. Well, you know, even if it's constitutional, who wants a tax burden of 5% just to pay all these boogeymen to go around and harass us in our
sure.
lives? So, you know, for listeners who maybe are not totally entranced with this subject, to me, I would always rely on those four things that they could fall back on to see through the light of Calvinistic doctrine of total depravity.
Right.
The problem being, again, the problem of the police having a monopoly on force, the problem of an organization investigating itself, the problems with lack of accountability in law enforcement, and then lastly, the problems of having a professionally paid witnesses in a court. But, of course, there's plenty of other things we can talk about on this topic, too. We just scratched the surface.
Yeah, we've got a good half hour to go here, and I want to encourage people in the chat room. I know Dexter and Emily are in there. If you want to ask a question, type it out, and I'll give it to Robert. And I think the point about total depravity is a good one. I think of how it relates to public school and how so many Christian parents, I think it's over 90% of Christian parents, they have an implicit trust in man. You know, in our circles, we distinguish between man as man and man as redeemed. We're not talking about man as redeemed. We're talking about men who are degenerate, who are teachers in the public schools, who are soldiers in the U.S. military, who are cops in local law enforcement. And most Christians don't even challenge these people, these pagans who are degenerate, who are antichrists, who don't have your best interest in mind, and Christians almost worship them, even though we know as Calvinists they are totally depraved. And that makes no sense
sure.
to me.
I think, you know, it's a disturbing problem why they look up to him so much, and to me one of the answers to that is how Christianity has been increasingly feminized over the past couple of hundred years. There was actually something I just encountered this past week. It was a reference to a book. It was called The History of Civilization. It was The History of Civilization in England, which was published in 1869. It was a three-volume set. Henry Buckle, who was supposedly no friend of Christianity, wrote it, but he had some interesting comments about where he thought that the Protestantism or Christendom in general had slit its throat, or the church had. And he said, and I quote, among the innumerable symptoms of this great movement, that being Christendom, there were two of peculiar importance. These were separation of theology, first from morals, and second from politics. The separation from morals was effected late in the 17th century, and separation from politics before the middle of the 18th century, end quote. And this, I think, goes a long ways to kind of explaining how the church has become increasingly feminized. And obviously, if you were to set foot in a charismatic church, which I don't recommend anyone do, but where you'll frequently see, you know, two out of three people in attendance will be women. But it's generally a problem across the board. Another book written by Leon Poddles was called The Church Impotent, The Feminization of Christianity, and I've not read the entire book. But what I've read, it points out that this is a problem going back well into the 1700s. And I think by the fact that Puritan New England was Unitarian by 1800, and the problems that we see in the U.S. Constitution, and for the listeners, I'm an anti-federalist, so I believe that, you know, the Constitution was a document that centralized power. But the language used in the Constitution, and particularly the Declaration of Independence, it very much smacks of Freemasonry and the Illuminist movement, the religion of Illuminism, which you found a lot of its it being formally worked out in Freemasonry. But certainly after 1800, more and more the church has just shrunken away from tackling important issues, and it's become very pietistic, of just focused on individual piety and in his relationship with God. And I think that the female proclivity for gullibility and being overly trusting has now worked its way out into the Christian church for so many decades that it's got this now a very naive view of people in general, cops, soldiers, teachers. Mm-hmm. And so on one hand, they will confessionally, in Reformed churches, confessionally say, oh, well, we believe in total depravity. But functionally, they're reverting to the behavior of the people around them in their church and in their community, which is to assume, hey, we're all Americans. We're all great. The very truly troubling set of Americans we have in prison. And the final book has not been written on that subject yet, but that's where I think a lot of the problem goes back to, with this trusting of authority and giving it almost no second thought whatsoever.
Yeah. That's, since we're in the area of theology here, perhaps we could discuss some theological issues that pertain to the police system.
Well, certainly the lack of casuistry, the refusal to discuss ethics, which, as the author I quoted earlier alluded to, I think started to break down in the late 1600s. But it's one thing to go from that to go as a problem that you'd had recently, where you were open carrying and you'd walked into a drugstore, I believe, and the clerk was scared to death.
Yeah, I was out with my family. I was taking them to a park to go play in a playground, and I stopped in to purchase some drinks, and I had my firearm on my side. I was well-dressed and clean-cut, but she still was a little bit alarmed and asked me if I was a cop, and I told her I was not a cop, just a armed citizen, and she relaxed a little bit, and I think at the end of the day, she felt safer. But it took.
Or she was certainly taken aback by seeing you.
Yeah,
first.
She was.
I think this is again the feminization of the church, and certainly amongst the clergy, we've seen a real problem. In France, there's a saying, and this is more directed towards the Roman Catholic Church, but I think you could apply it to Protestant America as well. There's three sexes, men, women, and the clergy. And you see this, I mean, you and I certainly know examples of clergymen who are not that way, but they're just that, they're exceptions. And where you see most clergymen are very effeminate, and they tend to avoid conflict. Their theology we would very frequently describe as pie in the sky, and the insanity of the charismatic movement, which tends to believe in miracles on demand, and if you're a really righteous person, then criminals won't bother you. I think also as well, in terms of theology driving the problem, we've already discussed a little bit about the zero tolerance move. And during the Reagan administration, there became all these mandatory sentencing guidelines for drug crimes, ISO 9000 and American companies. That in America, we've seen kind of a rise of the rejection of the old Reformed tradition, which was very much focused on systematic theology and the need for wisdom, to where now we have a theology that emphasizes the cherry picking of verses and just, excuse me, I'm losing my train of thought here momentarily. That with biblicism, we're all just going to find a single verse, pull it out, and we're not going to worry about wisdom. We're not going to worry about systematic theology. And I think that problem in the church has very much manifested itself in the world as well, too, of where a person in a company may say, well, I've got processes that I've got to follow. Well, maybe those processes are not conducive to the employees doing their job. And the person will say, well, sorry, I got a process. And we've heard just insane interpretations of the Bible, not only in the areas of, say, eschatology or soteriology, but just current events as well. When you say something bad about the government, the pastor will very frequently try to smooth things over and say, well, Romans 13, and that's that. A reading that would certainly not have been approved of by any of the early reformers in the church. And, so many of our problems in society are driven ultimately by theology. And I would love to see a turn away from biblicism, going back towards the systematic theology of old. But once again, with the feminization, you're dealing with the anti-intellectualization of the church as well, too. So it's kind of like the perfect storm of all these horrible factors coming together, and you can't really fight one without fighting them all. But it certainly gets to be a little bit lonely fighting on all fronts and alienating everyone you know. But that would be kind of a quick rundown of things. We've already talked about the veneration of the rule of law. A couple other issues to bring out in terms of the rule of law, and I'm going to use corporate examples. Total quality management, that was one of these early quality schemes that ultimately morphed into, I think it's called today's Six Sigma Black Belt System, and where quality is never assumed to be the result of someone who cares about their job or quality materials or a good design or good manufacturing. It's considered to be a process-driven thing. And along those lines, there was a book that came out in the around 2005, 2006 called Inside Delta Force. It was written by one of the founding members of Delta Force named Eric Haney. He was saying one of the main factors that caused people to drop out of the selection process wasn't that they couldn't do it physically, but the fact that Delta Force training tended to not tell you what was going to happen next. It might say, we want you to do a 5-mile hike, and we're not going to tell you what the time is for you to do it. Just go do the hike, on your own. Do as best as you think you can at it. And a number of people dropped out because they could not handle the lack of structure. You know, throughout America, and in the church too, there's this overwhelming demand and love of a structured environment. We have to have the magic public school teacher with the magic education degree to give us the structured learning environment for the student. Or with the problem with the police, we have to have professional police who've graduated from police academies to provide us the structure for society to exist. And you see the same thing in the business environment. And that would kind of be, I think, a quick rundown of the issue with theology involving police, although we could spend, obviously, hours talking about it.
Sure. This reminds me of a, I guess it was 8 years ago, I was actually looking to get into some different type of work, and I didn't know then what I know now, and I applied for several law enforcement agencies to become a cop. And I applied for the state police here where I live. And the application process was very rigorous because of do this, do that. You had to type it out in a typewriter, all this nonsensical stuff. And it could have been easily done online using a form. So I went through all that and had it approved. They called me in for an interview, which was very intimidating. And I had to appear before a panel of decorated officers, both male and female, young and old, and they were asking me questions on the spot, questions I had no idea what was coming. And I passed that, and then I was invited to come down for the physical, and I passed that with flying colors. And then I was invited to come down for the psychological exam, which consisted of two parts. It was a written test, and they asked every single question you could ever think about, from your education background to whether you were molested to your views on authority. It was a real in-depth, profound psychological profile. And then after that was over, the part B of this was to go upstairs and get all tuned up with these gears and do the lie detector test. And they only asked three or four questions on the lie detector test. And I can recall one of them was, have you ever transported illegal drugs? And that's the one that he told me I failed. And I know, as an honest to God truth, that I have never transported illegal drugs. And so I'm thinking in my mind, and he's just trying to get me to hang myself. And I said, look, I'm answering it properly. And he tried to intimidate me. He's like, well, I'll be right back. I'm going to go downstairs and talk to my supervisor and see what he says. And so I had 10 minutes to sweat as I waited for him to come back upstairs, and he didn't change his mind. He told me that his system says that I'm lying and that I'm not going to make it. And so that was it. I held my ground and said, look, I answered truthfully, and I'll see you later. And so I got a letter in the mail about 2 weeks later saying that I revealed information during my polygraph that was not conducive to becoming a police officer. So I'm thinking that the real truth came out in my written test, where I revealed myself to be an independent thinker and things like that. I'm not a centralized order taking slave, and I like to think on my feet. And they don't like creative thinkers. They want people. Pardon me. They want people who just obey orders, and that's probably why I was dismissed.
Did they ask you any control questions when you took the polygraph? It was before the official questions began.
Control questions?
Yeah, control questions are to establish a baseline.
Yes, they did.
On a polygraph.
Yeah, they asked me just simple questions like, is your name Christian Gray? Yes.
Okay.
Are you
okay.
A male? Yes. Yeah, because they wanted to find out how your body reacts to truth. But you know what? When you're put under the gun and you're asked these questions, I mean, even if the question is like, have you ever raped a small boy? You're going to feel nervous answering that question, even if you haven't. So,
you know, one of our favorite theologians, Rufus Rushdoony, he considered the use of polygraphs to be unchristian because they were a way of, well, I think for several reasons, but one of which was he thought it was a means of bearing false witness against yourself, where people could interpret it that way, where they interpret the results one way to say, oh, well, you know, you're lying. Another is I think it's this quest for secret knowledge, a kind of a Gnosticism of things that, you know, that you cannot determine. But I tend to agree with what you're saying, though. I think they just used the polygraph as the means to throw you out, but the written test is what got you bumped off the list, but they were not going to say, oh, well, you think too much for yourself, because
exactly.
It sounds so bad. We're going to say, well, we found something incriminating in your character. It's funny, though, because there are a number of ways of getting a lie detector, a polygraph, to give false readings of where you can run in place before taking it, or you can hold your breath, a number of ways of upsetting the body's chemistry, to then you will end up, if you can't, at least it'll give you bad results.
Yeah.
And it speaks a lot of volumes to me of the nature of organizations, whether it be the police or the National Security Agency or the Central Intelligence Agency, all of whom use polygraph in their hiring. If they put such great faith in a mechanism that has so many flaws in it, and that are known flaws.
Oh, yeah. The part that bothers me is that I know of at least one individual who got hired onto the same branch, and I know him for a fact to be a foul-mouthed, fornicating, pot-smoking, and at one point, pot-dealing jerk, and he's now a police officer, and I'm not. So, I don't have...
Sounds like the test worked the way it was supposed to.
Yeah, I don't have any regrets.
It is amazing how these organizations, you know, where they'll hire professional psychologists to write employment tests to guarantee a result that 95% of their hires will act in a certain way. And they're generally, you know, pretty good at predicting those kinds of results. When I applied at Walmart back in 1987 to walk at their Walmart, at a local warehouse, for just a summer, that I took it was a written psych eval test, and the results they were mailed back to me, they said that you're too individualistic to work at Walmart.
Of course.
Yeah, to which I wanted to reply, well, guilty as charged. You know, I'm not an automaton. I'm not a robot and won't fit into your system well. But I think that as with the police hiring, as with, say, like the Skull and Bones organization, that it's considered better to have someone who's morally compromised. Whereas a person who's of sterling character would more likely rat out fellow officers for, you know, taking a bribe or using force improperly. Whereas a person who's morally compromised will be much less likely to rat the person out, that they're just there for themselves and to not make waves. That the religious person, the convicted Christian, he's always problematic in that kind of a work environment. And while he does have good attributes and traits that I think would make them, you know, less likely to abuse force or to take bribes, ultimately the issues about protecting the promulgation of the organization itself. And they don't want anyone who might bring controversy to the organization.
Agreed. Well, we have, it's 10:55 here in Eastern Standard Time. We'll try to go just 15 more minutes and let you go about 10 after 10. I know you have a late dinner to eat. Let's, if we can, try to get through as much of this next topic as we can. That's the issue of societal problems and the formation of castes that local law enforcement currently creates.
This is another aspect of law enforcement that is very, very seldomly written about. If you have, let's say if you have a church setting and you have a cop in it and you got the other men who are not cops, so this man can show up bearing arms and no one else can. No one else is allowed to. And it tends to have a neutering effect on men that they can't, I mean, obviously we can, in a lot of places we can pursue concealed carry, but it's never quite the same as being a policeman. He has power that the average man cannot have. And it's not the thing, as with concealed carry, where you can't go in and pass an 8-hour test or examination and come out and be allowed to open carry and carry handcuffs and have arrest powers. No, I mean, it's if you want to have the powers that sworn police officers have, you have to, it's full time. You have to dedicate your life to it. You see the same problem in the church where there's not really the issue. You know, part-time clergy really don't exist. If you have a talent for teaching, well, you have to be considered a full-time teacher. The way this works out in society to me is with the neutering of man, of whether there is no militia to handle really large threats, there is no posse to handle small threats, that you have this neutered male that is basically powerless in many areas. And not just that, of where he also cannot represent himself in court, at least if he wants a chance to succeed. He cannot practice law. He can't buy his own drugs that he needs for his own medical needs. He has to seek the prescription of a physician. And so this powerless man, he becomes kind of a juvenile in many ways, or he tries to cope with it in other methods. With black people, very frequently they'll become members of street gangs to try to find, you know, outlet for their machismo. Amongst whites, a lot of them will join the military, which, you know, is its own, you know, with its own hour-long program. But they'll act out in other ways as well, too, sometimes the beating of their wife, or where they'll just be lesser men, and so then perhaps they'll pursue materialism, or they'll express their masculinity by seducing many women. It's basically an aspect of men that we are supposed to be able to have to defend ourselves and defend our communities, and we don't have that. And so our communities are also weaker for it, because as you as a neighbor, you know, I don't need you. If I have a problem, I'm supposed to call the police or call the fire department or call social services. This has led in turn to weaker communities. I mean, could you imagine what kind of street you would have if you had a neighborhood watch organization that actually had teeth in it? That, you know, okay, you know, you're not to walk down the street on patrols Tuesday night, and you know, where you walk down the street maybe for 30 minutes on end. And the men don't have any respect because of this. There are, amongst women, cop groupies that, you know, like to sleep with policemen and who want to be married to them. And the average man in the street is considered kind of a weak and pathetic person, if you get right down to it. Have you seen that kind of, you know, action yourself in terms of like men at church where, you know, they worship policemen, the worship of power because they don't have it themselves?
Yeah, I have. I think it's really common. There's a cop that goes to our church now, and it seems that ever since he showed up, he has this automatic special respect that no one else gets.
It creates a real division in a church or in a neighborhood alone. I mean, the women very frequently are like, let's hear what Officer So-and-so saying, thinking is on this. Whereas you may have a man in the church that he's, you know, was reading SWAT magazine back in the 1980s, like I was, mm-hmm. and knows a lot more about handling oneself in, say, in a house with an intruder than a cop is, where maybe he's fought his way through a tire house, but has not really thought about the good tactics of room clearing.
Yeah, everyone's always.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say everyone's always concerned about what Officer So and So says, but what they don't realize is that as soon as vaccines become mandatory, public school becomes mandatory, spanking becomes outlawed, that same officer will be at your doorstep enforcing those pagan laws.
Sure, but with a Christian twist, because he prayed before he did those things.
He prayed to Jesus.
It creates a real caste system too, and you know, one of the best ways I can think to illustrate this is going back into the military. That you have commissioned officers and enlisted ranks. And there is a very much a line of division between those two. They have their own club, the officers' club, and then the non-commissioned officers, which are just senior enlisted men, have their own club. There's certain things one group can do that the other can't do. They wear different types of uniforms, particularly in the Navy. And it creates this really unhealthy social system where you have the lower level caste, which would be enlisted, and the upper level caste, which would be your officers. And in the American system, due to the use of occupational licensing and just other evil aspects of the state, we have that problem with doctors, where they have the power of life and death via prescriptions and the ability to order tests. Then lawyers have their own set of power through occupational licensing that only they can be judges, because you have to have the bar accreditation. Likewise, you have the police problem. And the man on the street, probably I would say 98% of most men do not have the special powers that come from being a doctor or a lawyer or a policeman. And you have the major lack of respect, of self-respect, the decline of neighborhoods, the decline in churches, of where, let's say, a church wanted to offer a medical service to help people out that didn't have a lot of money. Say part of that is administering IVs. Well, if you do that without having some sort of licensed physician on premise, you're practicing medicine without a license, and you can go to prison for that. Our whole society, ultimately the rich people kind of tend to conspire with one another to make sure that their kids have favored slots in society. And the police were, I'm not sure to what extent, due to their involvement in Freemasonry, if this represented kind of a blue-collar backlash against that. But as in the case with unions going against the evil corporation, you can have a society in which both halves, neither side are the good guys, and the upstart becomes just as evil as the people they were fighting against. In most cities now, where you have, say, an organized crime problem, an unorganized crime problem, and then you have the police problem, and the average man is unable to do anything to counteract that due to the powerlessness it's left him with. And it drives our standing army problem. I mean, this is a topic we could get off onto some other time, that a lot of the cannon fodder that exists for our military, I believe, exists because the people cannot bear arms in their own neighborhoods. If they could protect their own neighborhoods, just even as a private citizen, let alone being a part of a posse or militia, I think you would see a drastic, drastic drop in enlistment into the military, as well as a drop in interest in ROTC programs. And that would be one more step of killing the standing army. And, of course, with no standing army, you can't engage in our adventurous foreign policy.
I would love for you to talk a little bit more about the idea of a posse, because I don't know much about it. I'm all for subsidiarity and local. Politics is local and justice is local. So what is a posse and how would that work out with the local sheriff, for example?
Well, you could have your sheriff, which in most places is an elected official, and where he could actually oversee the the jail on a day-to-day basis. And being theonomous, we obviously don't believe in prison systems, but if you were having to hold violent people, the sheriff could oversee that. He could oversee the office where, perhaps the administrative staff are needed to maintain files. But let's say a SWAT team application of a posse, where we don't have a bunch of full-time guys that practice sniping all the time or room breaching. we have a group of just civilians who hold normal jobs, but in their off hours, you know, they practice the art of sniping or of clearing a room in case there was a hostage situation. In many parts of America, the part of East Texas I grew up in, one town we had a volunteer fire department. We didn't have paid firefighters. And these were men who ran, like one ran a propane dealership where he drove around, you know, refilling propane tanks during the day. Another man was a pharmacist. Another one was a mechanic. And so, but these guys would get together, say, once a week and you know, practice, you know, putting out small fires, and maybe two or three times a year they would practice against larger structures. It was a very cheap way for to have a fire department. We used hand-me-down fire trucks, but they were all mechanically reliable. Well, you just apply the volunteer fire department thinking over to police thinking. One, get rid of the patrol officer and start thinking, applying the fire model with the police force, where, you know, fire trucks, fire departments don't drive around looking for fires to put out. They only respond once there is a fire. So you have the sheriff's department. Someone calls in and has a problem. If it's a very simple issue, maybe the sheriff himself goes out to it. But if it's a more of a hardier crime, then the sheriff pulls out the control roster for the posse and says, hey, we've got a hostage situation at some bank.
Right.
And so these people mobilize and go down and deal with the problem in a similar fashion the volunteer fire department would.
And the people that are called to go take care of that bank situation are going to be, they're going to have the best interest because it's their bank, it's their community. It's not some global system, some larger system where they're imported from different counties or whatever. So the question I have, and this one was asked by Dexler Mosley in the chat room, Moser, what about mixed race societies? How does this system really work out practically? Because, for example, if I live in a neighborhood that's half black and half white, or maybe a third black and a third Hispanic, I'm going to give preference to my kin. So what about that dynamic?
Well, I mean, the short answer is it really doesn't work.
Yeah.
or it doesn't work very well. And that gets us back to the need to have segregated societies, which, of course, the Civil Rights Act, I think it was 1964, that did away with that, where you could no longer show preference or discrimination in housing. And no, it works poorly. The problem with the blacks is very daunting because they're so much more inclined to be involved in crimes. Then the problem with the Mexicans is daunting because many of them don't even speak English.
Right. Yeah.
And they have their own code of, I believe it's called Omerta, which the mafia, you know, had, where they would never rat out another person. And you know, the blacks aren't going to rat out blacks to other, the whites or the Mexicans, and the same problem with Mexicans as with blacks. So in the short term, you would have very much a problematic situation. I think probably where, you know, the whites should serve as whites, and I'm really not sure if, you know, at this point, if blacks, if they could raise up a posse class out of the few responsible black people or not. And it remains to be seen. I'm not convinced that they could do it, but they probably need to have the freedom to. The Mexicans, the same problem rises up, but I would hope with time what would happen is if you could see the abolishment of the public school system and the abolishment of the various civil rights acts, that people would start self-segregating again, and where you would start seeing not only preferential treatment to people of one race, but also discriminatory treatment to people of another race.
The average person is going to think that question is, you know, racist or unfair, but let's think about it. I'm going to be more willing to respond to a hostage situation at an MCL cafeteria than I am at a Popeye's Chicken.
Sure. One, plus you understand white people, you understand how they think.
Yeah.
With blacks, their language has already become different enough through Ebonics, which the criminal class of blacks is much more inclined to speak, that maybe you'd have a harder time judging their intentions. This might lead to, you know, unnecessary bloodshed in a situation like that. With the Mexicans, it's much worse. If they are Spanish only speaking, you have no idea what they're saying. If you walk in there, if there's two or three members of the posse and you're facing six armed Mexicans, if they start gibbering in Spanish, well, you know, maybe they're planning on shooting you in unison. You just don't know. And then, you know, that's the failure of the multicultural society, or more correctly, the multiracial society, that we can't judge the intentions of people in other races, or at least it's much more difficult to. That's an excellent question, though. And it just shows how bankrupt American society really is, that we've got just layers and layers of problems to deal with.
It's a quite a convoluted problem we're in with the multiculturalism. I want to probably wrap up at this point. We have a lot more to cover, and if you'd like to come back in November, I'd love to have you back on, Robert.
Sure, you bet. We've got a lot more we can talk about.
Absolutely. I know it's getting late. It's 10 after 11, and you've got dinner to eat, and most people are getting ready to go to sleep, maybe go to church in the morning. So we'll wrap up for now, and I'll try to have this podcast on demand tonight. If not tonight, I'll work on it Monday morning so people can listen to that and put it on their MP3 player. And I want to thank you all for tuning in to this edition of Tribal Theocrat Live. We'll see you next time.